were here for thousands of years, generations, and in 120 years, the people, non-native people that have come over, have managed to change our environment because they stopped using fire.
Welcome to the Intentional Fire Podcast. This podcast is a collaboration between the Kudik Tribe's Department of Natural Resources and the Southwest Climate Adaptation Science Center, or Southwest CASC. This podcast builds off of a report called Good Fire. The report, commissioned by the Kudik Tribe, describes the barriers to intentional burning and identifies potential solutions.
Ayuki. My name is Vicki Preston, and I am a Kudik, Yurok, Paiute, and Pitt River Indigenous auntie, artist, and community member. I live in the area of Takasthuf Katathuf, or Perch Creek, in the larger area known as Orleans, California. I grew up in and around Orleans and have lived mostly at the mouth of Red Cap Creek, where my grandparents have their home. Our relationship to fire is multifaceted. Most people who live here have wood stoves. We have all seen many smokehouse fires, cooking fires, ceremonial fires, on smaller, more contained scales. On a little larger scale, growing up, I'd watch my grandpa burn. I sometimes got to help him and knew people in our area who also burn piles, brush, and understory. The inspiration to learn more about fires and the health of our ecosystems stemmed from this history, along with my own moral beliefs from ceremony and a desire to use Indigenous tools to live in Indigenous ways. To build this understanding of fire as a piece of my own understanding of what it means to be an Indigenous person, I've branched into work I currently do at the Kudik Tribe's Department of Natural Resources as a cultural resources technician. A lot of my moral beliefs started before my job now, and my cultural basis was largely learned outside of work. But my current job is a place where I use a lot of these skills. Cultural resources is archaeology and traditional ecological knowledge, and much of our work is to restore prescribed burning practices to Kudik Aboriginal territory. This podcast came from a collaboration found through my work at DNR. This podcast was created to amplify the voices of Indigenous people along the Klamath River and nearby places. And with this work, we want to center conversations around fire in the various ways it's present in our lives. This interview was conducted in the early summer of 2021. Kathy McCovey is a fierce Kudik gatherer, knowledge holder, and plants expert. She remains active in her arenas of fire, archaeology, ceremonial practice, and traditional knowledge, offering a lot of her time to the youth and visiting schools to teach many generations. Her work with fire is in prescribed and wildland, and I encourage everyone to hang with Kathy. She's a joyous and hard worker. Our interview actually took place amongst a crowd of youth workers through Kudik DNR's Pick Job Department out at Upper Camp Creek in Orleans. Kathy's interview will touch on some elements of the Slater Fire of 2020, as it did affect her directly. Well, you do everything, Kathy, and you work with fire so much, but you also worked for the Forest Service and you're a tribal person. So can you just introduce yourself? And that can be in any way you want.
My name is Kathy McCovey. I was born and raised on the Klamath River. I was raised in Happy Camp by my grandparents, Ernie and Esther Spinks. And they had moved up from downriver around Soames Bar area. My grandfather was sent to Sherman, and he learned to survey there, and he learned skills that when he came back to the river, he and my grandmother married in 1941, and they moved up to Happy Camp, and they bought a house because that's where the work was. At that time in the 60s, there was a lot of logging going on, and there were a lot of openings in the landscape, and we would go in and we would get black caps. We would go up and look for hazelnuts. My grandma would take me and my little cousin Larry down river to fish. For sometimes she went down and she would fish for her dinner, for our dinner. And my grandpa used to take me out in the field when he did surveys. They would hire him on a weekend because he was a surveyor. And I can remember some of my fondest memories was being out there with my grandfather, you know, and he's surveying and stuff, and I'm just running around, looking around the woods. Also with my grandparents, one of my earliest memories is them taking me down to Ishipishi Falls. And my grandmother and I were sitting on an old wooden bench. It was built around a white oak tree. And we could look down at the falls and see the men fishing down there. And there were a lot of older ladies and ladies with kids up around this bench. It since had been cut by Caltrans to put the road through. And they used to get a lot of fish, and yeah. That was part of my diet. And my grandfather always went hunting, and I got to go with him, and he taught me how to hunt. So my Uncle Casey, he did a lot of basketry materials. Around here, when you're growing up, there was a lot of older basket weavers that would come, and they would come to Orleans, like Bertha Peters and Draxy. They were paid by College of the Redwoods to come to Orleans and teach basket weaving. And that was in the 70s. And so that's how I started learning how to weave a basket. And then Laverne, I worked with Laverne Glaze a lot. She did a lot of basketry, but she was also a hunter, fisherman, you know, gathered. That's our lifestyle that we grow up in, and that my grandparents grew up in, and then their grandparents is living off the land here to subsistence living, to be able to have the food, quality food, and a variety. And that's how Native people have always lived around here. Was every month there was something to gather, something to do. If you've been down to the local market, they don't have a lot of food in there. And they are focusing on alcoholic beverages there, which is sad. And up in Happy Camp, the prices are really expensive, but the food's not really that good because it kind of gets shipped in late. Having the ability to subsist off of the resources that are all around us is very important, and it adds quality to our life, but it also keeps a lot of us off the streets. You're busy with the kids, you're out, you're working. When you go out, you're working also towards ceremonial season, you know, when they have the ceremonies in the summertime. So a lot of the work you're doing in the winter is things that you'll use or bring out that's prepared for the ceremonies in the summer. And all of the younger generation, they like to go to the ceremonies. And a lot of them know about the forest and want to know about the forest, but then a lot of them are unable to because they don't have access. I do a lot of teaching, and I learned a lot of skills. Watching my grandparents, how hard they work and the type of work that they did. And then I just grew up doing the same thing. So I had 40 years with the U.S. Forest Service here on 30 of it on the Six Rivers National Forest, and then I worked on the Sierra National Forest. I worked up in Alaska on the Tongass for a couple of seasons. And so I've been, on the Klamath too, that was my last one. And there was never a job I would turn down. And when I was working for the Forest Service, when I started, I got in on a fire crew. We were the fire crew. I did my 3 years on the fire crew on a fire engine, and then I went to work in timber. So on fires and our slash burning, we were the district personnel. Every one of us were out there digging line, lighting the fires off, and making sure that, you know, if they jumped over the line, and then we would put them out. And that's a heavy logging time, 1970s and 80s. Mm-hmm. They used to go out and do clear cuts, about 160 acres. But anyway, that's where I gained a lot of my fire experience. And then I stayed with fire as a tribal resource advisor. I actually went up as a crew boss on fires. And then since I became an archaeologist, anthropologist, I switched to doing tribal resource advisor on fires. So, retired from the Forest Service, went to work for the Cut'uk Tribe, doing climate change assessments currently. And also, I work for the North Coast Resources Partnership and the California Indian Environmental Alliance. And I am their fire and forestry consultant because we are trying to pull a lot of the tribes in California, the smaller tribes, together. We're getting funding that's coming into California due to these large wildfires. And we're one of the mechanisms that are funneling that money out to the local communities. And right now we've noticed we don't have a lot of firefighters, and we've got these big fires going on. So our emphasis right now is tribes and getting resources to tribes monetarily and supporting tribal projects and getting our fire crews, our local firefighting crews now, the tribal ones are the ones doing initial attack, because a lot of the agencies, the Forest Service, CAL FIRE, etc., have a lot of their people fighting the bigger fires.
One of my first things I think of when I think of you is that you're a teacher and you're always like willing to teach and stuff. Where do you think you've gotten that from? From your grandparents?
Yeah, I was raised with a family that we always taught and passed down information. But our family was together. And then it got to the 50s and the 60s where a lot of people left the river, the younger generation, and they left with their kids. So a lot of them didn't have the exposure. The jobs weren't there. People ask me, what did you lose in the Slater fire? Well, I lost a couple cabins. I lost my gathering area, and I lost, you know, the hunting area, and we've just lost that whole canyon. But for Native people, there's always a negative and a positive. So, you know, now we have areas opening up, and they're being reforested with hardwoods, and the Douglas fir is getting killed. So we're getting some of our meadows back. So there's always positive when you always look on both sides.
A lot of the local folks have been out looking, and they've already gone back in there and started evaluate what's there, what's coming back. Because that's just what you do, is you go back to your places and see what's going on there. And that was hopeful for me to hear that there's stuff coming back, because it was really burned hot in there.
Yeah, if you really look at it, it burnt out a lot of those even-age Douglas fir plantations that were planted by the Forest Service. So those trees are dying. They're dead. But the hardwoods that were intermixed with there, they're sending out shoots. So at that point, you could go and do what you call coppice. Cut out all the little other sprouts. Leave a couple sprouts coming off the main stump. One of those sprouts are going to become dominant. And then there, you've got your root ball and you've got your new sprout and your new trees. Now is the time to send crews in there and start cultivating that area into what we want. You know, you could run fire through there, through the burned areas. One of the ways that I look at it is that Douglas fir, which carried the fire, that was the fuels for the fire. And they had the ignition source, which was the power lines. And then the wind, east wind, very unusual hot east wind that are becoming the norm for the climate
early
change.
Early in the day.
Yeah. Those are dangerous to us, those winds. So anyway, when I see the fire area now, I see a lot of hardwood sprouting back. If they don't do anything, which I think is what they're going to do, there will be another fire coming through at another time, because all that young stuff is going to die and it's going to fall down and pile on itself. It'll just do self-thinning. And then when we get lightning strikes, because if we get a lightning storm through here, it's not unusual to have 137 fires. Yeah, and you can't catch them all. You know, so the ones further out are going to burn. The ones not threatening the communities, those turn into our biggest fires. But I look at the area now at Indian Creek and the Slater fire area, and I think, okay, here come the hardwoods. And then you have to have those hardwoods coming back in. You see this area, it's got a lot of shade, and that's what the Douglas fir likes. It comes in under the shade. So successional stages are, if you burn an area like Slater, then come the forbs, then come the brush species with the animals, and then come some of the tree species. So we like to run fire through it to stop the successional stage. Because if at that point, if you don't put fire in it, you're going to get a lot of young Douglas fir into your area, and you're going for a type change. There was fire used around the main village site. Let's say Orleans, and we was Panomnik. We still call it Panomnik, but Orleans, for maybe around, give or take, a 2-mile radius. And that was for a fine grain mosaic. That was for oak woodlands, grasslands, edible medicinal plants. Basically protection, too, from the fire. But also, they learn, you know, people were here for thousands of years, generations. And in 120 years, the people, non-Native people that have come over have managed to change our environment because they stopped using fire. And the reason they had this beautiful environment was because fire was utilized. About 2 miles out from the village site, there was another ring that was about a further 2 miles out, and that was managed for the brush species, like what we see, a deer browse, mm-hmm. and visibility underneath the canopy. And then beyond that, they feel was a combination of the Native American burning and lightning strikes. So you have a heavily, like you said, managed area. A lot of times people call me and ask me to go out and get them plants, herbs. And I usually will go right to an area that has been burned because the plants that come back are lush. And so fire for us, it also prepares the plants like hazel and bear grass. If we burn them back, prescribed burn, and then they come back out, the shoots have less outer, on the blades of the bear grass, have less outer bark, and it changes the cellular structure so that we can braid them and use them for our baskets. Hazel sticks are the same way. You burn them down to the base, they sprout back out, and then their lesser bark and the cellular structure inside the stick changes.
I'm curious what you think about, like, how we're able to do prescribed burning, like, today. Are we able to get all of the right timing that we want? That's like, Tishonic was like a late spring burn. And then there's burn windows that happen even in, like, winter or early spring,
yes,
right?
Those ones never get taken opportunity.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Well, I know it's bureaucratic. And I know it has to do just, I believe, with agencies and people who permit us and these that we have to work with to get them to understand. I just don't understand. Yeah, they like to burn in the summer. Oh, they're saying nowadays that they can't burn in the winter. Hmm. Well, now the fire crews are just kind of there and they're on call all the time.
So if they're not on all the time, does that mean they're not available in the spring?
They are not available. And I talked to one of the FMOs. They are so tired from moving all over the United States and working all these fires for 2 weeks at a time. They work 2 weeks at a time, get 2 days off, rest, and then boom, they're back on whatever fire.
Yeah, it's just like back to back.
So they've got families that haven't seen them. I mean, divorce rates are high for firefighters because they're gone most of the summer, and then when they get back, it's Thanksgiving, it's, you know, it's Christmas, it's Valentine's Day, and then they will start coming back in to the fire workforce around March and April and May. So that's when they're doing all their training, so busy training. So it leaves these big holes, and this is steep country. So if you do any type of brushing and stuff to get crews, it costs a lot of money. And where does the money go to get people to work in the forest that is not emergency related? Anytime there's a fire, boom, they get money for everything.
Do you feel like the way that we react to wildfires, is that like a barrier in itself to prescribed burning?
Yeah, and it also is a type change. It changes the type of forest that we have in a totally different forest.
Yeah.
So there's no continuity. Yeah. The continuity is with the tribal folks that work as resource advisors on the fires. We are going to have to locally have our fire crews. I don't know. The money's got to come in from somewhere.
But in general, I feel like, you know, those agencies have more of the money than resources than we do, but we often have a lot of that really valuable knowledge.
And the workers. You know, there's a lag time that I've seen in the Forest Service. I was working in 2010, and they were doing a project on Elk Creek. They came in and they told us, you know, we run these computer models, and we are seeing the high flame link. So this is where our money is going. Mm-hmm. To like the Elk Creek area, because it showed one of the highest flame links. And that was 10 years ago. And I retired in 2013, and then now it's 2021, and I see that Elk Creek is finally making it onto the SOPA, Schedule of Proposed Actions. But there was always planning, and money for planning. No implementation. So that fire implemented itself. It was a lot of vegetation. It hadn't been thin, acres and acres. There were 3 mills in Happy Camp. Mills had to be fed. People with lumber, people had to work. So they cut out a lot of the older trees that are more fire resistant and replanted with conifers.
I wonder why there's not as much effort that goes into the implementation versus like the planning part.
I don't know, but I know that we call Happy Camp the Revolving Door Ranger District. There was a picture that I took. This is some of the folks in Happy Camp, and it's an area that got burned in Slater Fire, but it was a tree plantation. Now look what's coming up underneath of there. Thimbleberry. The seeds and the root systems and stuff stay dormant for a long time. Fire came through, burnt all that dug fir and leaf litter and everything. Now, look how many of them. To me, that was an old gathering area for because it's right off of the canyon. There was a village adjacent. So when some people see this, they go, oh, yeah, great. You know, and that's what it says. They're planting trees. They're heroes. I look at it, what the hell are they doing messing up the thimbleberry crop? You know, that is what was there. And now they're planting their superior trees there again.
I can't believe, are they replanting it just plantation style?
Yeah, it's their superior trees. They went around and they got cones from different places and different elevations. Then they went sent them down to Placerville Nursery or some nursery, had them germinated, grew into trees about 4 years old or so, and then brought them up. And now they want to see what trees produce the most cones. They're still in this timber stand, growing timber mindset. It's stand and compartment management. But we don't really do that anymore. I mean, the Forest Service really doesn't do that much anymore. You know, they're morphing. They're having an identity crisis right now, and they're starting to morph.
Yeah, they're coming into a time of, like, needing to change it up somehow, I guess.
You know, you have a whole industry. The fire management crews will show up. They've got an entourage of probably a couple hundred people. They have their own, you know, their own favorite kitchen and their own favorite people from their places, like Arizona, follow them. One team even had its own Winnebago church. But see, we don't fight with the land. It's the thing that we need, and it's what they see as valuable and monetary versus what we see as valuable. And the dominant culture gets away with this type of generic management because they say they're managing for everybody in the United States.
You mentioned that you worked as a resource advisor for the Forest Service. So are you able to provide input that guides that at all?
We are listened to. The thing is, we have a tribal relations person on the fire, and he works directly with the team, the liaison for the team, and the tribe. So they're consulting the whole time that the fire is going on through that tribal representative, who also supervises me. We know what they're doing, and we're agreeing to it right there in the planning. That's where the tribal rep is, in the planning. He's in there saying, well, I need Kathy and so-and-so to go over here. Or we need the Karuk One, K1 crew, to go over to the spiritual area and to dig a line around it. And so we work really closely with the incident command team. I tell them, I'm here to help you do your job. And whatever you need, I will help you do. So it's keeping that open dialogue. Now, not all tribes are fortunate enough to have an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. So when a fire happens and as it gets bigger, they'll start calling more resources. As a fire gets closer to sensitive areas, which, you know, we consider, everything in from the bottom of the river to the top of the mountains and up in the sky is, you know, our business. we're sensitive to. And the Memorandum of Understanding is what allows us to be hired as tribal resource advisors by the U.S. Forest Service. And then we work for the Forest Service, we're hired, but we're also working for the tribe. And our assignment basically is to help these fire crews establish lines and areas and do what they have to do to suppress the fire, but we're protecting our cultural sites. Or in some ways, you know, when a fire goes through our cultural sites, it's better for it.
Yeah, and like you're saying, all these resources, all this money, and so you say, like, local folks, the tribe didn't know it was even going on, or was seeing results that were, like, a negative impact.
Yeah, because they were backfiring a lot. Mm. And that's really dangerous, I think, and in that it ends up having a type change. You have to understand what time of the year, when, or time of the day, the winds, you know, humidity, etc., to have good fire. Yeah, it's war to them. I don't want to fight war anymore or see anybody fight war. We don't have to have like a panic situation when it comes to utilizing fire.
So like backburning is basically from the lines that they've created, mm-hmm. they're going to start set their own fires. Mm-hmm. But that often means that it results in a lot of hot fire.
Because they're up on the ridges.
Yeah.
That's where our lightning strikes happen. So they start fighting fire on the ridges. So they start putting lines in, then backburning. The wind comes up, blows the fire over top of them, and then they get ember shooting down, the Klamath River Canyon, which is steep, and then they land in the middle of the thermal belt of the, mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking high-ass peaks. And then it's just raining embers down on the Salmon River people. Salmon River people were so angry about the Forest Service going there and burning again. They actually told us that they were about ready to go out and block the road.
Can you explain about how climate change and just...
It's coming really fast. The thing is that we're ignoring it for a while. And then all of a sudden, you know... I've been watching it for quite a few years because I've been doing the climate change plots and I've been seeing what's going on with the plants.
You're really good about tracking changes like that.
Yeah. and plus I drive up and down the roads all the time, mm-hmm. and I commute from Orleans to Happy Camp. So I'm seeing this stuff all the time. And it's dynamic because we're just starting to get hit hard. Yeah. This was really odd. You know, and a lot of people are going, well, maybe this is just an anomaly, and next summer we'll have the rain and it won't be so hot. But the hotter, it's so hot that it's drying out and killing the green plants. And that's going to add to the fires. You know, it's going to add around here because you're getting die-off of all these lower limbs. That's all ladder fuels in there. Mm-hmm. And once it gets, you know, burning and air good, and then this will just... burn through here.
Yeah, this would burn pretty good in here. Just looking at all the grape and all the brush, you know.
Well, this was an old campsite.
Yeah,
Native American campsite. So it was managed, one of the higher ones. It has a really an interesting assortment of plants that you don't find down this low in one of the little boggy areas back of this camp here. Yeah, and this is only about a mile up from the main village, and there's all kinds of resources to gather. Yeah. And then summertime, this is really cool. It'd be really hot down in the village, you know, so hanging out here and then having different camps on the way up. My grandma told my uncle told me that his grandma told him that, and she said, we have everything we need in front of us and behind us. And it was that way then, in the 40s, and it's still that way, but we're not allowed to manage for our own selves. It's like people are getting mad about, well, I don't have any rights because, you know, we're all treated to equal. But in that vein is that our rights are being taken away from us to be able to gather area and manage an area so that we can have food and animals from it, and just a lifestyle, cultural lifestyle that's been here for thousands and thousands of years. So that's real hard, is that a lot of people, especially from the city, don't want anything cut. You know, don't want any type of management. But when you look around, you'll see there's a lot of stems per acre, you know, of different type of trees. And those, because of the drought, because of the competition, they're going to kill each other. It's basically self-thinning. And if we don't go in and do something, it will kill, you know, they slowly die off underneath. So anyway, this is one of the most species diverse areas of the continental United States. And we use fire to dictate what plants grow and what plants don't, and the different times of year that we use it.
One thing I wanted to ask about was your role as an archaeologist that you've played over the years with the tribe and with the Forest Service. And how has that kind of been a way for you to use your tribal cultural knowledge while also using whatever maybe you've learned as an archaeologist?
So I'm the person that helps the tribe and gets the agencies and the public to understand that we live in the forest now, we've always lived in the forest, and we will always be in the forest. And I can go into areas and look at the plants and find artifacts. Mm-hmm. So I'm the one that connects. I put the human aspect in the environment and the manage of it. It's always been the other. Uh-huh. The forest is the other. A lot of people don't know the names of the plants in a forest or their uses. Mm-hmm. I have the ability to read the forest. I was a forester, so I was trained how to grow trees. I went to Humboldt State University and College of the Redwoods for forestry. And fire is just, that's a tool that humans have learned to control a long, long time ago, and that's what helped us become as smart as we are. And we need to learn how to live with fire, manipulate the vegetation to accept fire. And I feel like I put the human aspect back into forest management. Why are we managing? You know, people are just really interested in the types of sticks that we have for basket in our basketry, mm-hmm. in our ceremonial regalia. And so if there's an interest and an appreciation for that, and it's unique to this area. So I feel that whenever possible, I need to teach people about the plants. And also as an archaeologist, I was trained to do research. So it's easy for me to get in to documents and to find stuff and to find these old ethnographies and these bits and pieces of information. So I just think it helps me to see things holistically. And at the Forest Service, a lot of times when I was doing civic culture, I was accused of being unfocused. But it's the focus is... You know, and I told them, okay, it's easy to take the big trees out of the forest. We've been doing that since the 40s. What's hard is what you have left and how to manage and to manage for the people.
Thank you for that. And thank you for whatever you've taught me and I'm sure everybody here. Do you have any kind of advice for the youth, what you see as where we should go from here, or advice about where we live and why is it unique for us? What really brings you passion to do a lot of what you do?
Oh, a lot of my passion comes from being a tribal person that's been excluded from the management of the forest. Mm-hmm. And when I begin to go to school, I begin to learn more things. And I became more of a solid foundation to speak my mind and to be the change mm-hmm. that needs to happen, because we're a community and we're a community in place, and we've been in place for a long time. Now, I worked for the Forest Service. It was a fun job. It was. They taught me. I know how to do a lot of things because I worked for the Forest Service. A lot of times I didn't really feel my heart wasn't into what they were doing, how they were manipulating the vegetation. But now where I am, I'm with the tribe. And we're working towards a goal of being more involved in fire, in forest management, etc. Being at some point co-managers. And so it's one step at a time. And for the younger people just coming out of school, I say, you know, you can either go to school or to be successful, or just go to work. you know, on the fire crews. That's some of the easiest work that you can get hired on, because there's not a lot of people that want to come to Orleans and Happy Camp to be on a fire crew. It's not a destination.
Yeah.
It's not a destination. It's our destiny to be managers of this forest. And so it's easy to keep going and working and then to go back with them. And the longer you work and the further, the many times you come back and show up for the next season, like the higher you get a step increase, you get up higher, move up. And education part, that'll move you up really quick. 2 to 4 years of education. Mm-hmm. I'm an archaeologist. I went to school for archaeology, and I enjoyed going to school for archaeology. I actually excelled at going to school. And I was like in high school, I was the one trying to figure out how to get out of school. And I didn't really do that well in high school. In order to make a difference, you have to show up. Everything that I've accomplished, I know that other people can accomplish. Because if I can do it, you can do it. Other people can do it. And again, you'll find your niche. And I have always loved what I do. I mean, at my heart, I just love it. I'm so lucky to do what I do. You have to put your energy out nowadays to work, because there's nobody going to support you. And our community needs you.
Yeah.
You know, that we are the managers. And so the more of us are educated, the more of us that can stand up to agencies and say, you know, that's not right, you know, that's not right, or that's not good, or that doesn't benefit, that type of management does not benefit our community. Yeah. You know, we want to work together, and we want to help you help us, instead of just being extraction, commodity. In real life, it's supposed to be, well, this is public managed land, managed for the public. Oh, the Forest Service owns it and manages it for its own purposes.
They're the one
manipulating
people.
The vegetation and denying us access, yeah, or resources, because they're still stuck in when timber was. And but they can take the conifer, please, by all means, you know, because the conifer is, you know, the secondary, yeah, that's the one that's sending that stand into more of an old growth characteristic, and that's has no food underneath for the animals. So native people want the conifer out, but then you get the environmental groups that don't want us to cut anything over 23 inches. They're sitting back there, wherever they're at, you know, in their chair, their armchair quarterbacking, and saying, well, we don't want anything cut. Well, some places you don't want anything cut, but some places you do. Some places you want the certain species and you don't want the other one. It is manipulating the environment, but more for the community needs, like it used to be before, yeah, contact. So there are strangers coming in and making decisions that affect us. And what I'd like to see in the future is a lot of Native people working. And I always said yes. I'd never turn down assignments for anything. Mm-hmm. Calling spotted owls, going on fires, going out and, you know, digging out the culverts. It's that attitude and energy that you put into things will make it successful. And I am just an example of a lot of people on the river who haven't had the chance to be sitting here in my chair, or to be working with different agencies or the tribe. And so, again, anybody can do what I did. And I wish they would.
Well, I really appreciate all of your, all the work that you've done, Kathy, all the stuff you've taught, and just being, you're such a hard worker. It really inspires me to do all the different things we teach you, that you got to stick with one thing, or you got to do one thing. I appreciate your creativity, your groundedness amongst all of that. I always like talking to you, and I always like working with you. So.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you, Kathy. Just a short reflection on this conversation with Kathy, especially now, a year later, when we're facing new fires and facing new impacts from smoke and impacts to our local communities. It makes me think about fighting fire as also a time to manage the fire and manage the land. I do really appreciate talking to Kathy.
She always really makes me think, and she thinks about things so holistically, the land, the fire, how it's moving, and the community. I always am inspired by her passion for this work. This podcast episode is part of a mini-series called Intentional Fire Podcast and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to learn more about this topic, we invite you to listen to our other episodes. This podcast was made possible through a collaboration between the Cudahy Tribe and the Southwest CASC, with funding from the U.S. Geological Survey and the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Arizona. This interview was conducted by Vicky Preston and Anna Mervite. The podcast was edited by Ellis Julin and Vicky Preston, and the drumbeat in the episode was from Brian Tripp, Cudahy. Thanks to the Cudahy Resources Advisory Board Review Committee, the Southwest CASC Fellows and Advisors. A special thank you to Stormy Stotts for the use of equipment, and thank you all for listening. Yotwa to everybody who supported and patiently waited for the completion of this podcast.